technologically more advanced than the populations of Eastern Europe, but lagged behind those of Western Europe. In the early 19th century, Britons came to Germany to create railroad systems, and Germans went to Britain to study the advanced technology of the times. Germans, however, were for centuries the principal intermediaries through whom the advances of the West moved eastward with a lag. German cultural influence pervaded the urban centers of Eastern Europe from the Baltic to the Adriatic. Over the centuries, the interactions of the Germans and the Slavs have ranged from economic to military. In the Middle Ages, the Mongol invaders from Central Asia forced Slavic populations westward from the Ukrainian steppes, and the Slavs in turn forced the Germans westward. Later, the Germans forced the Slavs back eastward, with the Oder River forming a boundary between them, then as now. But Slavic-German interactions were not limited to the interactions of whole societies. Enclaves of Germans were scattered throughout medieval Eastern Europe, bringing with them craft, industrial, and agricultural skills more advanced than those of the Slavic regions. Many products of Western European societies, from coins to castles, moved eastward in medieval times. So did more advanced agricultural methods, such as improved plows, the horse collar, and new systems of crop rotation. Germans living in Eastern Europe became, in effect, enclaves of Western European culture there. The landed nobility of Eastern Europe often deliberately attracted German farmers by allowing them to settle in towns and villages under German laws. Hundreds of villages in Silesia were under German law at the end of the 13th century, and more than 1,000 by the middle of the 14th century, when more than 100 towns were also under German law. Germans were the predominant population in many Eastern European cities during the Middle Ages, while the Slavic populations predominated in the countryside. Until 1312, the official records of the city of Krakow were kept in German, and that year they began to be kept in Latin. It was decades later when Poles became a majority of the population of the city. For centuries, rural and urban populations differed in ethnicity throughout Eastern Europe and the Balkans. During the Middle Ages, most of the towns founded in Croatia and Transylvania were founded by Germans. Adriatic port cities such as Dubrovnik developed under Italian cultural influence, and Sarajevo under the cultural influence of the Turks. In Romania as well, Romanians were not only a minority in many of the towns and cities, they were a subordinate minority, working as servants and unskilled laborers, while Germans, Jews, and others predominated in higher-level occupations. Even after Slavs and other Eastern European populations became, over a period of centuries, numerically predominant in the cities of the region, Germans remained the elite in such cities as Riga and Prague, and members of the local populations who wished to rise economically and socially had to learn to speak German and become part of the German culture in order to do so. One reason for the German cultural predominance was simply that they were literate much more often than the indigenous populations of Eastern and Central Europe. Most Russians, for example, were illiterate in the late 19th century, but 94% of the Germans in Riga could read and write. In the Austrian Empire, even as late as the beginning of the 20th century, the illiteracy rate of Polish adults was 40% and among Serbo-Croatians was 77%. But among Germans, only 6%. Education, however, was just one symptom of a vast difference in skills between the indigenous populations of Eastern Europe living overwhelmingly in the countrysides and the skills of the outsiders living in urban enclaves among them. Merchants from the indigenous populations in East Central Europe were usually unable to compete successfully with more experienced merchants who came from Western Europe and other places with a long history of commerce. Even in agriculture, places with rich soil such as Romania and Russia had lower crop yields than those in Western Europe, where agricultural practices were more advanced. The difference was in the people rather than the soil. German farming communities in Eastern Europe likewise had higher crop yields than those of the surrounding populations. During the Middle Ages, the mining skills for which Germans became widely known led to the establishment of predominantly German mining communities in the Balkans. German priests converted the Czechs to Christianity, and the University of Prague, the first university in Eastern Europe, was founded in 1348 with a predominantly German faculty. Dorpat University in Riga, established by the Tsar in 1802, was likewise in effect a German university on Russian soil, with nearly half its faculty coming from Germany itself. Although Germans were only about 1% of the population of the Russian Empire, they lived clustered in enclaves, both urban and rural, that remained culturally German for centuries. In the 1880s, more than half the Russian foreign ministry was German, as were nearly all members of the St. Petersburg Academy of Sciences. Polish authorities imposed German agricultural practices on Polish peasants. German words crept into the languages of Eastern Europe, and Slavic rulers in medieval Mecklenburg gave their children German names. In Russia, there were such phrases as punctual as a German, and as honest as a German. The transfer of skills and cultures into Eastern Europe was by no means always socially harmonious, however. Those who had cultural advantages resisted having their cultures diluted by the culture of the indigenous people around them, and the indigenous people resented those advantages and the foreigners who had them. During the Middle Ages, Slavs were barred from membership in some German guilds in Eastern Europe, and members of those guilds who married Slavs were subject to expulsion. Conversely, Germans were barred from employment in a Polish hospital founded in the 14th century, and an organization founded among Czechs in that same century required that those admitted must be born from two Czech-speaking parents. Mob violence was unleashed against Germans in Krakow in the same era. With the eventual rise of an indigenous educated class, resentments were fanned as these newly educated people led in the promotion of group identity movements, intolerant of outsiders, and insisting on preferential treatment and the imposition of the group's language and symbols on others. In 1892, for example, street signs in Prague, which had been written in both German and Czech, were changed to become exclusively Czech. Group identity movements were not confined to Czechs by any means, but were led by the intelligentsia, including students and lawyers, among a number of groups in the Habsburg Empire. It was much the same story in the Russian Empire, where an emerging Latvian-educated class, educated at culturally German Dorpat University, promoted group identity agitation in the Baltic. Among Germans of this later era, whether in the Habsburg or the Russian Empire, a cosmopolitan attitude long prevailed, rejecting arguments or policies based on ethnic origins, and welcoming into the German culture the educated classes of Latvian, Czech, Jewish, or other origins who chose to share in that culture and had achieved mastery of it. German was the language of Prague's educated classes, whether in business, the clergy, or the military, regardless of the ancestry of the individuals involved. However, the unrelenting promotion of group identity politics by others, directed against people of German ancestry, eventually led to a defensive solidarity among the Germans, and thus to ethnic polarization. The full and fatal fruition of these group antagonisms would come only in the 20th century, when discrimination and violence against Germans in Czechoslovakia, for example, made them ripe for Nazi propaganda and willing accomplices of Hitler's takeover of that country. Elsewhere in Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, abused German minorities likewise collaborated with the German invaders during the Second World War, and many of them accompanied Hitler's armies on their retreat back into Germany. After the war, millions of Germans, whether collaborators or not, were forced to go back to Germany from Eastern Europe, many of them dying either from mob violence against them or from the brutal conditions in which they were suddenly seized and transported. The Potsdam Agreement among the victorious Soviet, American, and British governments facilitated these mass expulsions, but the expulsions and the hatred behind them were visible even before that agreement. In early May 1945, Czech nationalists, in conjunction with communists, began to treat the Germans of the Sudetenland like the Nazis had treated the Jews. Murders, atrocities of all kinds, thefts, expropriation became the order of the day. Even before Potsdam, Germans were required to wear white badges, were allowed on the streets only at certain times, and were forbidden to ride on public transportation or even walk on the pavements. Certain types of German property were confiscated, and special ration cards were issued to Germans, denying them goods the Czechs could obtain. More than 3 million Germans were expelled from Czechoslovakia. Millions more were expelled from Poland, Hungary, Romania, and Yugoslavia, often under brutal conditions that led to deaths on a large scale. German culture. In an era when all general characterizations about peoples are likely to be met with cries of stereotypes, it is especially useful to note the consistency of these characterizations of the same group living in lands separated by thousands of miles of land and water. Even in times before modern communications, when people in South America had no way of knowing what beliefs existed in Russia about the Germans living there, or how similar those beliefs were to their own observations about Germans living in South America. The ease with which charges of stereotypes are made suggests that those with flesh and blood people before their eyes have been mistaken more often than observers far distant in space and time, and relying on general presumptions, a proposition that lacks even plausibility, much less evidence or proof. Craft skills. Long before German societies became industrialized, Germans were skilled craftsmen in many fields. Germans were known for brewing beer in Roman times, and Germany today produces more beer than any other country in Europe. People of German ancestry have set up breweries as far away as Australia and China, the famous Tsingtao beer of China having been created by Germans there. The leading American brands of beer, Budweiser, Coors, and Miller, were likewise all created by people of German ancestry. German breweries in Buenos Aires drove English beer out of the market there. In the Brazilian state of Sao Paulo, the only producers of beer in the early 20th century were Germans. Beer-brewing Germans are not simply a stereotype. German craftsmen also pioneered in making pianos and took this skill with them to other countries. The first pianos in colonial America were built by Germans, who also led the way in building pianos in Australia, Russia, France, and England. German craftsmanship also created optical products that made such firms as Zeiss, Schneider, Rodenstock, and Voigtlander world leaders in high-quality lens production. The leading lens-making firm in the United States was founded by two German immigrants named Bausch and Lohm. Printing was another area in which Germans led the way. Gutenberg introduced printing with movable type in Europe, and centuries later, Germans set up the first printing press in the Western Hemisphere. When printing presses began to spread from Western Europe into Eastern Europe, they spread first into German enclaves in the East, because here were concentrated people who could read. Germans also pioneered in map-making. The name America was given to the Western Hemisphere by a German map-maker. Mining was another area in which Germans became renowned as far back as the 16th century. Copper mines in Britain were opened up by Germans, as were silver mines in Mexico, Spain, and Norway, in addition to the German mining communities in the Balkans already noted. German craftsmanship in metal created the first armor and swords manufactured in Mexico, as well as the renowned Kentucky rifle, which was in fact made by Germans in Pennsylvania. For thousands of years, Germans excelled in military operations. German generals held positions of high command in the Roman legions, as they would in later centuries command armies in Tsarist Russia, in South America, and in the United States from the Revolutionary War of 1776 to the two world wars of the 20th century, in both of which the U.S. Army was commanded by generals of German ancestry, Pershing and Eisenhower, respectively. German commanders of American military forces in the Second World War also included Admiral Chester Nimitz, who commanded the Pacific Fleet, and General Karl Spatz, whose bombers reduced much of Germany to rubble. In both world wars, the armies of Germany inflicted far more casualties on opposing forces than the Germans sustained themselves. During the Middle Ages, the Teutonic Knights conquered Prussia, which became the heartland of German military prowess for centuries to come. German fighting men were in demand by rulers in Eastern Europe and in the Ottoman Empire, and were used by the British in their attempt to suppress the rebellious American colonies, as well as by the Americans in order to bring their citizen army up to the military standards required to fight the British. Ironically, Germans produced not only leading military men, but also leading pacifist groups, such as the Mennonites, who also spread to other countries. Whether in agriculture, industry, commerce, or the military, Germans became known for thoroughness, organization, punctuality, and hard work, as well as for specific skills. Other countries not only welcomed German immigrants, but some actively recruited them, and in some cases, subsidized their travel. Not only in Eastern Europe, but also in developing nations in the Western Hemisphere and in Australia, Germans were recruited to pioneer in opening up undeveloped wilderness. Cultural persistence. Wherever Germans settled around the world, there were newspapers printed in German. In Russia, the St. Petersburger Zeitung was founded in 1727, followed in later years by the Saratov-Deutsche Zeitung in the German agricultural settlements on the Volga, and the Odessa Zeitung among Germans who settled by the Black Sea. In the United States during the immigrant era, most of the foreign language newspapers in the country were German. St. Louis had two daily newspapers in German as early as 1845, and out on the plains, there was an Odessa Zeitung set up by German immigrants from Russia who had kept their language and culture intact after settling in Russia for generations and then resettling in the United States. German language newspapers were published daily in 15 American cities, with such names as Die New Yorker Staatszeitung, the Cincinnati Volksblatt, the Chicago Abendpost, the Louisville Anzeiger, and the Deutsche Zeitung in New Orleans. In Brazil, there was the Santa Cruz Anzeiger, the Deutsche Zeitung, and the Brazil Post. Elsewhere in South America, there were the Argentinisches Tagblatt and the Deutsche Zeitung für Paraguay, among others. In the Australian city of Adelaide, the Australische Zeitung was still being published in the late 20th century. These German-language newspapers in countries around the world were just one indication of the persistence of German culture among people settled for generations, or even centuries, in other countries. German settlers in Australia built houses and communities in the style that they had been used to in their homeland. A German traveler in 19th-century Australia wrote of an immigrant settlement there. There are German public houses, a German drugstore, German doctors, stores, blacksmith, carpenter, school, church. In fact, everything is German. The traveler would believe himself in some little village of the old country between the Rhine and the Oder. A rural village in Argentina was described this way by a visitor in 1967. I entered the church and heard something I did not remotely expect in this distant place. Traditional German hymns of Holy Week, sung in typical Volga German style in which each voice remains distinct. I looked around. Men, women, and children were in their Sunday dress. Some of the women wore scarves. Beneath them were faces like those of the country people in Germany. In front of the nave, the minister was preaching in common German to the parishioners. It was difficult to believe that I was in Latin America, that the ancestors of these people had left Germany for Russia 200 years ago. This cultural persistence among Germans around the world represented a loyalty to the particular subculture of the locality from which they had come, not a political loyalty to the German nation. Many had, in fact, immigrated before there was a German nation created in 1871. A 19th-century German community in Australia was described as the recreation of a Silesian village. In the United States as well, Germans from particular localities settled together and maintained the culture of that area. Frankfort, Kentucky was founded by Germans from Frankfort, Germany, and Grand Island, Nebraska by Schleswig-Holsteiners. Lomira, Wisconsin was settled almost exclusively by Prussians from Brandenburg, while the nearby towns of Hermann and Theresa were settled by Pomeranians. Even among Germans who immigrated from Russia to the United States, those who came from the Volga settlements established their own communities in the Plain States, distinct from the communities in those states established by those Germans who came from the Black Sea settlements. Even when they resettled again in California, the Volga Germans and the Black Sea Germans settled separately, the former around Lodi and the latter around Fresno. How long and to what extent the Germans remained culturally separate varied with circumstances. Rural enclaves tended to remain culturally insular longer and more completely than was the case when Germans settled in urban communities that included people of other nationalities and cultures. Where the Germans were the numerically predominant urban group, as they were for centuries in much of Eastern Europe, they could assimilate the local population, or at least its upwardly mobile elements, to the German culture. But where the Germans were greatly outnumbered, and especially where the great majority of the German immigrants were male, then interactions among groups, including intermarriage, eroded the German culture. This was the case in much of 19th century Australia, but not in South Australia, where whole families of Germans tended to settle together, and there were as many women as men, so that these communities could maintain their separate social and cultural identities for generations. It was much the same story in Brazil, where there was very little intermarriage with members of the local population living near German agricultural communities, well into the 20th century, while in cities and in some rural areas where there were more diverse populations, acculturation and assimilation became more common. Yet even living in cities with large numbers of people from other backgrounds did not automatically lead to rapid assimilation. In New York City, where 90% of the population was non-German, in the early 20th century, most people of German ancestry nevertheless married other people of German ancestry. That changed over the years, but not immediately or rapidly. This cultural cohesiveness was seldom accompanied by political cohesiveness or group identity politics. Germans were usually not very politically active in any case, and they tended to be underrepresented among career politicians. Where German political leaders arose in other countries, it was seldom as representatives of ethnic Germans in those countries. In the United States, for example, those people of German ancestry who did achieve prominence in politics, the Muhlenbergs in the 18th century, Carl Schurz and John Peter Altgeld in the 19th, and Herbert Hoover and Dwight D. Eisenhower in the 20th century, did so as representatives of the American people at large, rather than as spokesmen for ethnic German interests. There were similar patterns in other countries. In Australia, Germans tended to be underrepresented in politics, and those Germans who achieved political office were elected from constituencies where there were few Germans, as well as from constituencies where Germans were the predominant population. In Russia, the presence of Baltic Germans in high positions in the Tsarist government was of no benefit to the Volga Germans or the Black Sea Germans, in whom these German officials took no interest and whom they looked down on as peasants. In Brazil, Germans long remained politically apathetic until after the Second World War, when they began to elect more deputies. However, in places where the German minority was under sustained political attack, such as by the Latvians or the Czechs, Germans were provoked into political activity. The persistence of German culture did not, in most cases, mean making public dramatizations of a separate identity, exceptions again being in places like Czechoslovakia. More commonly, Germans maintained their culture without making a public issue of it. In the United States, such American sports icons as Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig grew up speaking German, and so did Nobel Prize-winning economist George Stigler. Education. Among the things that Germans had in common, wherever they were from and wherever they settled, was making education a high priority. Even among German farmers pioneering in the wilderness of 19th century Brazil, German schools appeared in the first clearings in the woods, while most native-born Brazilians remained illiterate on into the 20th century. This reflected the high priority of education among Germans in Europe, where the term Kindergarten originated and where the German research-oriented and doctorate-granting university became the model for modern American universities. Education was not just for intellectuals or academics, however. German farmers and craftsmen learned to read and write, even in times and places where the surrounding population was illiterate, as in most of Eastern Europe and in Brazil. Education became the foundation for German prominence in the professions and in science and technology, both at home and abroad. In 19th century America, one-third of all the physicians in New York State were of German ancestry. As already noted, in Tsarist Russia, Germans predominated in the St. Petersburg Academy of Sciences. In Argentina, German academics predominated in the Institute of Physics, Astronomical Laboratory, Natural History Museum, National Bureau of Mines and Geology, and in its Institute of Military Geography. The German Nation. With the passing generations, the kinds of Germans who immigrated from their homeland changed, as that homeland itself changed. In the early 19th century, the small German states and principalities which existed prior to their being consolidated into a nation in 1871 were a largely agrarian world in which three-quarters of the population lived in small villages and towns. Its manufactured goods, such as textiles and metal products, were produced largely by artisans and craftsmen, rather than by large-scale industrial enterprises, such as were developing in Britain. While Germans were economically more advanced than the peoples of Eastern Europe, they lagged behind other countries in Western Europe in technology and in sophisticated commercial and financial institutions. But all of that changed during the course of the 19th century. At first, the Germans simply borrowed the more advanced methods of the British in industry and agriculture. Britons installed industrial equipment and built railroads in Germany and taught Germans how to operate both. British capital financed the Industrial Revolution of wool and helped create the German steel industry, with Belgians and the French also contributing technology to German economic development. Yet, once launched into the Industrial Age, the Germans surpassed their mentors before the end of the 19th century. The number of German steam engines tripled between 1834 and 1850, and between 1815 and 1850, coal production increased more than tenfold. Germans had nearly doubled the railroad mileage of the French by the middle of the 19th century. In the crucial area of steel production, Germany overtook Britain by the last decade of the 19th century. And, on the eve of the First World War, German steel production was double that of the British. Political developments were equally dramatic. When the German states and principalities were consolidated into a nation in 1871, it was the most economically advanced nation in Europe and militarily the most powerful, as demonstrated in its crushing victory over France that same year and its seizing of the iron and coal deposits of Alsace-Lorraine. Strong nationalistic fervor accompanied these dramatic economic, political, and military developments, not only among Germans in Europe, but also as far away as Australia. German immigrants from the new era when Germany reached the forefront of industrial development brought with them more industrial skills, more science and technology. Others took abroad artisan skills as before. While artisans and craftsmen were being superseded by modern industry in Germany, their skills were still in demand in other countries that had not yet reached that same level of technology. Germany's belated but dramatic emergence among the great powers of the world, like that of Japan in the same era, led to an aggressive nationalism that provoked armed conflicts with its neighbors. Although the First World War began with the Habsburg Empire's military action against Serbia, in response to a Serb's assassination of the heir to the imperial throne, it was Germany's military backing and urging that led the Habsburg Empire to take that fatal step, with the full knowledge that existing alliances and alignments risked bringing Russia, France, and Britain into the war. The same nationalistic overconfidence which led to Germany's willingness to challenge these powers later led to the sinking of American ships bound for Britain, bringing the United States into the war, thereby tipping the military balance toward the defeat of Germany and the dismemberment of its allies, the Habsburg and Ottoman empires. The rise of Adolf Hitler to power in 1933 and his swift transformation of Germany into a militaristic and totalitarian dictatorship set the stage for a new and more bloody world war, and, in the end, a more catastrophic defeat that now led to the dismemberment of Germany. While Germany rose from the rubble of wartime destruction to recover economically and eventually was reunited politically, the unprecedented horrors inflicted by the Nazis at home and abroad raised questions about the whole German culture and character that have not yet been put to rest in the 21st century. What the Nazis had done went far beyond launching a war. Their conscienceless persecutions at home and abroad, their racial fanaticism, and the murders of millions of unresisting civilians of both sexes and all ages reached unprecedented depths of depravity. As Time magazine commented after the collapse of that regime, "This war was a revolution against the moral basis of civilization. It was conceived by the Nazis in conscious contempt for the life, dignity, and freedom of individual man and deliberately prosecuted by means of slavery, starvation, and the mass destruction of non-combatants' lives. It was a revolution against the human soul." What did the Nazi era say about the German people who, after all, gave Hitler the electoral plurality that put him in power? How much of what the Nazis did reflected the culture and history of the German people? Political developments. The political freedom and individual rights, which are loosely characterized as democracy, had existed for less than a generation in Germany when Hitler came to power. Germany itself had existed for less than a century at that point, though there were Germanic states before, such as Prussia and the Holy Roman Empire, not to mention contemporary Austria, the remnant of the Habsburg Empire that had been ruled politically and dominated economically by people of German ancestry. Autocratic and authoritarian governments had long been the norm among Germans, as they had been across much of the world for most of history. Yet Hitler was more than just an autocratic ruler in a country with a militaristic tradition. What did putting Hitler in power say about the German people? Strictly speaking, it could reflect only on those Germans who voted Hitler into office in a democratic election, after which he seized dictatorial powers. Hitler never received a vote of a majority of the citizens of Germany, even to be put into office as chancellor, much less to become dictator. The millions of Germans outside of Germany, of course, had no part in any of this. Yet when all is said and done, there can be little question that Hitler's massive support in Germany reached levels of adoration seldom seen in any country before or since. How much of that was support for the Nazi ideology or its known agenda? Much less for its hidden agenda that unfolded later to shock and outrage the world. While Hitler himself was even more ruthless and reckless than the Kaiser who led Germany into the First World War, there was among the German people no such exaltation at the launching of the Second World War as had existed in countries across Europe when the First World War began, with both sides full of confidence of quick and easy victories. William L. Shire's monumental eyewitness history of Nazi Germany described the scene in Berlin on the first day of World War II this way. The people in the streets, I noticed, were apathetic despite the immensity of the news, which had greeted them from their radios and from the extra editions of the morning newspapers. Across the street from the Adlon Hotel, the morning shift of laborers had gone to work on the new IG Farben building, just as if nothing had happened. And when newsboys came by shouting their extras, no one laid down his tools to buy one. Perhaps, it occurred to me, the German people were simply dazed at waking up on this first morning of September to find themselves in a war which they had been sure the Führer somehow would avoid. They could not quite believe it now that it had come. What a contrast, one could not help thinking, between this gray apathy and the way the Germans had gone to war in 1914. Then there had been a wild enthusiasm. The crowds in the streets had staged delirious demonstrations, tossed flowers at the marching troops, and frantically cheered the Kaiser and Supreme Warlord Wilhelm II. Hitler counted on no enthusiasm for war on the part of the German people. On the contrary, he preceded his invasion of Poland with elaborate charades of seeking peace. In order to make it appear that the Poles had attacked Germany, he even staged border incidents, using Germans and Polish uniforms to fire weapons and leaving concentration camp inmates dying as casualties of the purported Polish attacks. None of this was expected to fool the outside world. That it was considered necessary to fool the German people, insulated by a government-controlled press, suggests a serious difference between the aims and values of the Nazis and the aims and values of the people whom they were leading and misleading. Differences between the goals and imperatives of the Nazis and those of the millions of Germans living outside the Reich were even clearer. The Volksdeutsche. As of 1935, there were an estimated 95 million Germans living in various countries around the world. 65 million in Germany itself, 6.5 million in Austria, 3.3 million in Czechoslovakia, and 1.2 million in the Soviet Union, as well as sizable numbers of Germans scattered throughout other European countries to the east and south of Germany. Many of these became involved politically with the German nation before and during the Nazi era in a way very different from that of people of German ancestry living in the Western Hemisphere or Australia. In addition to those Germans who had settled in Eastern and Southern Europe in centuries past, Germans living outside Germany, ethnic Germans, Volksdeutsche, as distinguished from German citizens living at home or abroad, Reichsdeutsch, included Germans who suddenly found themselves minorities in new nations created by the breakup of the Habsburg Empire, and Germans stranded across new national boundary lines created by the Treaty of Versailles that ended the First World War. While the Germans living in Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland were the largest and best known of these, others included Germans living in the South Tyrol that had been transferred from Austria to Italy, and Germans living in the newly reconstituted nation of Poland. These Volksdeutsche faced varying degrees of discrimination from country to country and from time to time, without discrimination becoming more severe during the Great Depression of the 1930s, when economic opportunities became more scarce for everyone. Years before the Nazis came to power in Germany, these Volksdeutsche, in other countries, organized themselves for various forms of protest and political activity and self-defense. Not only did the Nazis have little interest initially in these Volksdeutsche organizations and movements, the Volksdeutsche had little interest in Germany's Nazis, and even those Germans abroad who established relationships with organizations within Germany usually did so with non-Nazi organizations. Only as the Nazis saw a possible usefulness of Volksdeutsche organizations in furthering Hitler's international ambitions did they take an interest in them, championing their cause when it suited Germany's national purposes and abandoning them to their fate when Volksdeutsche interests conflicted with Hitler's national ambitions. Thus, while Nazi Germany championed the cause of the Sudeten Germans as part of Hitler's plan to take over Czechoslovakia and encourage Sudeten German militancy, extremism, and violence there, German officials were exerting pressure against Volksdeutsche in the South Tyrol to restrain themselves and accept Italian rule, since Hitler valued his alliance with Mussolini more than he cared about the fate of South Tyroleans. Similarly, Volksdeutsche leaders in Lithuania were pressured to restrain the hotheads in their ranks in order to avoid creating international problems that would distract from Hitler's current international strategies. The Volksdeutsche in the Slavic Protectorate were likewise sacrificed to Germany's international designs, and Volksdeutsche from the Soviet-occupied eastern region of Poland were relocated to Germany for the same reason. Perhaps the biggest clue to the Nazi strategy was that, during the years of Hitler's complaints about the treatment of Germans in other countries during the 1930s, emigration of those Volksdeutsche to Germany was discouraged. As disaffected minorities, they were useful where they were, both as fifth columns within countries targeted for conquest and as propaganda justifications for Nazi invasions. Prior to the achievement of power by the Nazis in Germany in 1933, the various Volksdeutsche organizations and movements were not Nazi movements or movements sharing the racial or national fanaticism of the Nazis. Only after Hitler came to power in Germany were they gradually won over to cooperation with the Nazis in their own self-interest as beleaguered minorities seeking allies and to varying degrees imbued with the Nazi ideology, especially after Germany's conquests cast them in the role of a master race, collaborating with Reichsdeutsche in the subjugation of the peoples who had formerly oppressed them. Among overseas Germans, things never reached that stage, and the ability of the Nazis to infiltrate and co-opt German communities and cultural organizations was far more limited. As early as 1938, authorities in Germany were aware of how little they were accomplishing with people of German ancestry in the United States, and cut back their activities there as a result. In short, among Volksdeutsche, as among Reichsdeutsche, there was little to suggest a predisposition toward Nazi aims or ideology before Hitler took power. Their role in and their responsibility for the tragedies of the Nazi era are an entirely different question from that of whether the prior history of the German people was one uniquely leading toward the Nazi catastrophes. Nationalism and Nazism. Fanatical nationalism was at the heart of the Nazi creed. To what extent did most Germans share that creed during the Nazi era? Was it a creed going back into history or continuing on past the Second World War? Patriotism has been common to peoples around the world, particularly in wartime, and especially when people have been led to believe that their country has been attacked. There is no reason to doubt the patriotism of the Germans during the Nazi era, but gauging public opinion in a totalitarian state can hardly be done with any precision. The euphoria with which the beginning of the First World War was greeted in Germany was all too common across Europe at the time. What of Germans outside of Germany? and across a wider stretch of history than a few decades of the 20th century. Despite the tenacity with which Germans clung to their own culture in the farthest reaches of the world, there was no such political loyalty to the German nation or its antecedents. Germans in Russia fought loyally against Germany in the First World War, as German Americans did in both World Wars. No one found it noteworthy during the Second World War that so many top American military leaders were of German ancestry, nor was any question of conflicts of national loyalties raised. In Australia, those Lutheran churches that were subsidized from Germany tended to be sympathetic toward Germany, while those subsidized from the United States were not. Yet, once Australia went to war, even the Lutheran churches that had been sympathetic to Germany before now urged their members to fight for Australia and otherwise cooperate with Australian authorities. The Nazis worked hard to infiltrate German organizations in the United States, Brazil, and Australia during the years leading up to World War II, but with only limited success, despite tactics that sometimes included threats of reprisals against family members in Germany if their overseas relatives did not cooperate. Where German minorities had been badly treated, as in Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union, it was a different story. Germans in the Sudeten region of Czechoslovakia helped create the crisis that was resolved at the infamous Munich Conference of 1938, where Britain and France agreed that Nazi Germany should take over that whole region of Czechoslovakia. Later, when the German army invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, Black Sea Germans welcomed them as liberators, as did some non-German minorities. And then, after the Soviet army counterattacked, more than a quarter of a million ethnic Germans followed the Nazi army as it retreated back to Germany. During the post-war Red Army occupation of East Germany, tens of thousands of former Soviet Germans were forced to return to the USSR, though tens of thousands of others used false identities to avoid this fate, and still others avoided it by committing suicide. During the war, many Germans in the conquered lands, suddenly elevated to privileged positions as members of the master race by the Nazi occupiers, collaborated actively, leading to a post-war backlash that led to the expulsion of millions of Germans as mass punishment, irrespective of individual guilt or innocence. The question here, however, is not the balance of justifiable or reprehensible behavior on the part of Germans in Europe during a period of several years, but the larger historical question of whether the Nazi ideology and its horrifying consequences represented an enduring set of distinctive characteristics of Germans as a people. Those Germans living overseas, in lands where they had no special grievances and were free to express themselves, showed no such loyalty to Germany as a nation, much less to Nazi ideology, as to sustain a conclusion of indelible cultural characteristics favorable to the values of Hitler and the Nazis. Racial fanaticism. The Nazi amalgamation of nation and race under totalitarian rule, one people, one country, one leader, led to the horror most unforgettably burned into the history of Germany and of Germans, the murder of millions of Jews and others deemed to be of inferior races. Was this the culmination of long-standing beliefs and actions of the German people, or a monstrous new creation of the Nazis? In Germany, as in other countries, there were people hostile to the Jews on religious, racial, or other grounds, nor were these isolated, anti-Jewish individuals. There were institutions, movements, and political parties hostile to Jews, sometimes bitterly and venomously so. And these included historic figures from Martin Luther to Richard Wagner. But the ultimate question is how all this affected the behavior of the German people as a whole, as compared to other peoples in Europe and elsewhere. Self-aggrandizement and bias against others has been too tragically pervasive throughout human history and among peoples around the world to make it a distinctive characteristic of a particular people or a particular era. However, racism in its modern sense of belief in innate genetic inferiority and superiority of particular races has had a shorter history, dating from the last half of the 19th century, when some regarded this doctrine as a logical corollary of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. Hostility to Jews, for example, had existed for thousands of years, But anti-Semitism, in the strict sense of believing in the biological inferiority of Jews as a Semitic people, was one of the offshoots of what was regarded as scientific racism. This new racism that wrapped itself in the mantle of science was neither peculiar to Germany nor limited in its application to Jews. In the United States, some referred to the immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe as the beaten men of beaten races, who would be incapable of being able to be absorbed into American society. The eugenics movement sought to limit the reproduction of inferior individuals and races so as to prevent the lowering of the national intelligence in future generations. Planned Parenthood was founded not simply as an organization for limiting the size of families in general, but more particularly to reduce the reproduction of the black population in the United States, as Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger herself noted. Such ideas were common among intellectuals who considered themselves progressive at the beginning of the 20th century. Ironically, although the logical corollary of this genetic determinism was that national IQs would fall over time, as less successful people with generally lower IQs tended to reproduce at a higher rate than more successful people with higher IQs, research in the last years of the 20th century showed that scores on IQ tests had in fact risen substantially in more than a dozen nations during the course of a generation or two. The question here, however, is not the validity of genetic determinism, but how widespread and how openly avowed it was during a particular era. Germans were neither exempt from nor unique in their susceptibility to this doctrine. Hitler's racism represented the gutter-level application of an idea discussed in more lofty tones at higher intellectual levels. Racism in our narrow modern sense has been a significant force for a little more than a century, while violent and lethal hatred of other groups goes back thousands of years. There were pogroms against Jews in Europe and similar mass slaughters of Chinese minorities in Southeast Asia, centuries before most people had ever heard of genetics. What, then, has been the record of Germans in this longer and broader history of intergroup hostility, discrimination, and violence? Comparing Germans with other Europeans for the sake of convenience, it seems clear that whatever differences there were historically tended to show the Germans not as intolerant as most Eastern Europeans, for example, toward the Jews. Jews fleeing from Eastern Europe to Germany constituted about one-fifth of the Jewish population in Germany when Hitler came to power. However tragic that was in the light of later events, it was a very reasonable move in light of the differences between Germany and Eastern Europe at that time. Jews were so widely accepted in Germany that nearly half of all Jewish marriages there between 1921 and 1927 were marriages to people who were not Jews. German Jews were noted for being far more assimilated to the larger Western society than were Jews from Eastern Europe. And this was true not only in Germany, but in the United States and as far away as Australia. German-American immigrant communities welcomed German Jewish immigrants as members of their Turnverein, singing groups, and other cultural organizations. 19th-century German Jews living in Chile and Czechoslovakia likewise took part in the general cultural life of German communities in those countries. Jewish views of pre-Hitler Germany were very favorable, not only in Germany itself, but overseas. During the First World War, American Jewish publications were so favorably disposed toward Germany that they were investigated and prosecuted for favoring an enemy nation in wartime, leading to the famous clear and present danger doctrine in favor of free speech by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in cases involving Jewish writers, Abrams versus United States and Schenck versus United States. Even some Zionists in Palestine returned to Germany during the First World War to fight for the fatherland. Jews were, of course, not the only targets of racial hostility, nor Germany the only place where such hostility was expressed and acted out. What has been the record of Germans with regard to other racial or ethnic groups in other countries and in other times? We have already noted the cosmopolitan tone that Germans sought to maintain in the face of group identity extremism among Latvians and Czechs, though in both cases the Germans eventually decided that they had to defend themselves as Germans. In the Western Hemisphere, the first anti-slavery meeting in North America was held by Germans in 1688, and Germans in Brazil were likewise opposed to slavery there. A History of the Antebellum South referred to a colony of anti-slavery Germans who settled in Texas, as well as Germans in Virginia who were antagonistic to slavery, and Germans in St. Louis who were strongly anti-slavery. When whites in early 19th century North Carolina voted to deny the franchise to free blacks, this disenfranchisement was opposed by voters in almost all of the western counties of the Piedmont region, where the Germans and the Scotch-Irish were concentrated. While Germans were split on many of the complex issues revolving around race and slavery, no prominent German-American leader was pro-slavery, and when the Civil War came, the large German population in Missouri was credited with keeping that state in the Union, despite many Confederate sympathizers among other Missourians. As for relations with the indigenous population of the Western Hemisphere, Germans were noted for getting along with the Indians better than other Europeans did, though all had clashes with the indigenous peoples at some point or other. Germans in Paraguay likewise treated the indigenous people in a more conciliatory manner than other Europeans had. In Australia, Germans established missions to help the Aborigines. As noted in an earlier essay, in the German colonies in East Africa, slave traders were hanged on the spot when they were caught in the act. The history of pre-Hitler Germans, whether at home or abroad, can readily stand comparison with that of most Europeans, just as the record of Europeans can stand comparison with that of most other races around the world. That is what makes what happened under Hitler and the Nazis even more chilling. If this could happen with Germans, it could happen with any other people. There were anti-Semites in Germany, as in other countries, and their words can now be read as alarming warnings in light of our knowledge of what lay ahead. But there was little at the time to serve as a credible warning of such a monstrous and almost inconceivable event as the Holocaust. Even if we confine the question to those Germans living in Germany during the fatal dozen years of the Nazi regime, the issue is whether the Germans of that era, or even those particular Germans whose votes put Hitler in power, were attracted to him for his racist agenda. In elections held from 1871 through 1928, German political parties explicitly devoted to anti-Jewish principles reached a high of 7% of the vote and a low below 1%. These parties included, but were not limited to, the Nazis. A study of anti-Semitism in Germany concluded, by 1914, the anti-Semitic parties were practically defunct and their press was in ruins. Hitler's speeches during the election campaigns of 1928, 1930, and 1932 made no specific proposals on what he intended to do about Jews. He apparently did not see German public opinion as ready for any of the actions that he would, in fact, later take against the Jews. When the desperation of Germans in the face of severe economic and social crises created by the worldwide Great Depression of the 1930s elevated Hitler from a fanatic in the streets to a dictatorial ruler, the die was cast, fatally. From that point on, it no longer mattered what most other Germans thought, whether about race or war or anything else. But before then, when voters in Germany had their last free choice, what were Hitler's supporters supporting? What did they know, and when did they know it? A study that attempted to answer these questions concluded, middle class and other voters did not vote for Hitler because he promised to exterminate European Jewry. Neither did they vote for him because he promised to tear up the Constitution, impose a police state, destroy labor unions, eradicate rival political parties, or cripple the churches. Even Hitler's Mein Kampf did not forecast these events. During the years leading up to the Second World War, Hitler moved against the Jews in orchestrated stages, allowing him to gauge the extent to which German public opinion supported his actions. A Nazi-sponsored boycott of Jewish stores in 1933 failed so badly that it was called off after 4 days, rather than have it be an ongoing fiasco. Even after 5 years of anti-Jewish propaganda in Germany, when the Nazis in November 1938 unleashed Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, featuring violence against Jews, their homes, and their businesses, the negative reactions of Germans, including some Nazi party members, led Hitler to proceed against the Jews thereafter with as much secrecy as possible. Even when Jews were rounded up and sent off to concentration camps, there was nothing at that point to indicate the grisly fate awaiting them. and it was a crime punishable by death to reveal the extermination program. Rumor circulated, and some undoubtedly knew more than rumors, but rumors and speculations always abound in wartime. Moreover, even those who were certain of what was happening had no ability to stop it in a totalitarian state, and they and their families could pay with their lives for publicly protesting. Even a prominent German Jewish leader like Leo Beck said that he did not know about Auschwitz and the systematic killing of Jews until 1943, even though millions of Jews had already been killed by then. Genocide against the Jews was a government program, not the lethal mob violence unleashed against the Jews in earlier pogroms in Eastern Europe, or against the Armenians in Turkey during the First World War, or against the Igbos in Nigeria in the 1960s, or against the Chinese in a number of Southeast Asian countries on a number of occasions over the centuries. Given the fact that Jews had been stripped of legal protections early in the Nazi regime, any of these things might have been done by the German people. Indeed, Hitler tried to represent Kristallnacht as a spontaneous burst of public outrage, rather than as the staged event that it was. But what the German people did not do in these circumstances may be more revealing about their own attitudes. None of this denies that there were anti-Semitic fanatics in Germany, both in the Nazi Party and among the German public. It simply makes the dimensions and duration of anti-Semitism among Germans at large subject to question. What must also be noted is that Jews were a very small minority in pre-Hitler Germany, never as much as 2% of the population, despite their prominence or even predominance in particular fields such as medicine, journalism, or banking. The average German had no compelling reason to be thinking about Jews, one way or another, and indications are that most were apathetic about anti-Semitism, both before and during the Nazi era. Nevertheless, the egregious behavior of the Nazis toward the Jews prompted some Germans to come to their aid, even during wartime, when that meant risking death for themselves and their families. Estimates of the number of Jews hidden in Berlin alone during the Second World War run into the thousands. As for post-Hitler Germany, perhaps the following capsule account from Commentary magazine, published by the American Jewish Committee, is as revealing as any. All told, Germany's voluntary payments for past wrongs amount thus far to more than $55 billion over a period of 6 decades, and are unparalleled in history. These were not the reparations after the First World War imposed on Germany by the victorious powers. These were reparations voluntarily paid by a democratically elected German government. This did not, of course, mean that all hostility to Jews had been obliterated in Germany. It does suggest that such hostility was not pervasive, nor necessarily greater than in other European countries. It is hard even to imagine such reparations being paid to persecuted groups by democratically elected governments in places like Rwanda, Uganda, Fiji, or other countries where minorities have been expelled or slaughtered. Summary and implications. The role of the Germans as bearers of more advanced skills to other countries in Europe and the Western Hemisphere has by no means endeared them to all these peoples. Farmers in Honduras complained about having to compete with German farmers there who worked too hard. Latvians and Czechs complained that to become educated, they had to learn the German language. This at a time when there was little serious literature in their own native languages. Russian farmers resented the greater success of German farmers there, and the rise of communism, with its theories of exploitation, enabled them to unleash an orgy of violence and destruction on German farm communities. In short, productivity does not imply popularity, whether for Germans or for any other race or class. The history of middleman minorities around the world underscores that point as well. Moreover, it is not usually the masses of the people who most resent the more productive people in their midst. More commonly, it is the intelligentsia who may, with sufficiently sustained effort, spread their own resentments to others. When considering the question of the extent to which the Nazi era in Germany reflected the culture or history of Germans as a people, two very different questions must be distinguished from one another. 1. The culpability of that generation of Germans who enabled, abetted, or promoted the cause of the Nazis and its catastrophic human consequences, and 2. The extent to which the prior cultural, political, or social history of Germans as a people made Hitler and the Nazis inevitable, likely, or an aberration. The first question is harder, but the second question has wider and more enduring implications. The issue is not whether there have been anti-Jewish individuals, institutions, writings, movements, or political parties in Germany. There were, in fact, all of these for centuries before the rise of the Nazis. But the ultimate question is, what was the net effect on the actual behavior of Germans toward Jews? Not compared to an ideal, but compared to the behavior of others toward Jews or toward other minority groups around the world. Here, the pre-Hitler behavior of Germans toward Jews compares favorably with that of most other peoples in most other places, not only in behavior toward the Jews, but toward minorities in general. This is no exoneration of anti-Semites, either before or after Hitler. Each generation and each individual bears the heavy burden of guilt for what they did, but not for what others did in other places and other times. Hitler's accession to power, followed by his coup of converting the constitutional power of a chancellor into the totalitarian dictatorship of a Führer, was of course made possible by the German voters who gave him a plurality in a democratic election in 1933, setting in motion this whole tragic chain of events. Yet the dictatorship, war, and Holocaust that we associate with the Nazi regime in retrospect was not on the ballot, or even on the horizon, of those who voted for Hitler in 1933. They were seeking a political savior in a chaotic and economically depressed time. The relative political apathy of Germans and their historic law-abiding habits enabled Hitler to seize far more power than he was elected to, with perhaps less resistance than such an action might have provoked in some other societies, and the German military tradition and military prowess made him more dangerous than he might have been as the leader of some other nation. Looking back through German history, one can find examples of anti-Jewish words and actions by both elites and masses. Tragically, that does not distinguish Germans from Europeans in general, or from human beings in general, when it comes to vile or vicious things being said or done to any number of ethnic or other minorities in countries around the world. But the Holocaust was unique. The question, then, is whether there was anything correspondingly unique in the breadth or depth of German antipathies toward minorities in general, or Jews in particular, in their pre-Hitler history. No such uniqueness stands out prior to the era of Nazi rule, either in Germany itself or among German communities around the world. The racial fanaticism of Hitler and the Nazi movement, which spread to the German generation of their day and led ultimately to the Holocaust, were not historically distinct characteristics of Germans as a people. On the contrary, the rise of such a man as the leader of such a people should serve as a permanent warning to all people everywhere who are charmed by charisma or aroused by rhetoric. Black education, achievements, myths, and tragedies. Will Rogers once said that it was not ignorance that was so bad, but, as he put it, all the things we know that ain't so. Nowhere is that more true than in American education today, where fashions prevail and evidence is seldom asked for or given. Nowhere does this do more harm than in the education of black children. The quest for esoteric methods of trying to educate black children proceeds as if such children had never been successfully educated before, when in fact there are concrete examples, both from history and from our own times, of schools that have been successful in educating black children, including those from low-income families. Yet the prevailing educational dogma is that you simply cannot expect children who are not middle class to do well on standardized tests, for all sorts of sociological and psychological reasons. This dogma is not even true for the children for whom it is most often invoked, black American children, much less for minority children in general, whether in the United States or in other countries. Schools, past achievements. Contrary to prevailing educational dogmas, there are schools in America today where low-income black and other minority students do in fact score well on standardized tests, both public schools and private schools, secular and religious. even as the vast majority of ghetto schools have abysmal performances on such tests. Moreover, there has been successful black education as far back as the 19th century. High-performance schools. In 1899, there were 4 academic public high schools in Washington, D.C., 1 black and 3 white. In standardized tests given that year, students in the black high school averaged higher test scores than students in 2 of the 3 white high schools. Today, more than a century later, it would be considered utopian even to set that as a goal, much less expect it to actually happen. Yet what happened back in 1899 was no isolated fluke. That same school repeatedly equaled or exceeded national norms on standardized tests in the 1930s, 1940s, and early 1950s. Back in the 1890s, it was called the M Street School, and in 1916, it was renamed Dunbar High School. When this information on Dunbar High School was first published in the 1970s, those few educators who responded at all dismissed the relevance of these findings by saying that these were middle-class children, and therefore their experience was not relevant to the education of low-income minority children. Those who said this had no factual data on the incomes or occupations of the parents of these children, and the data that existed said just the opposite. The problem, however, was not that these dismissive educators did not have evidence. The more fundamental problem was that they saw no need for evidence. According to their doctrines, children who did well on standardized tests were middle class. These children did well on such tests, so therefore they must be middle class. It so happens that there was evidence on the occupations of the parents of the children at this school as far back as the early 1890s. As of academic year 1892-93, of the known occupations of these parents, there were 51 laborers, 25 messengers, 12 janitors, and 1 doctor. That hardly seems middle class. Over the years, a significant black middle class did develop in Washington, and most of them may well have sent their children to the M Street School or to Dunbar High School, as it was later called. But that is wholly different from saying that most of the children at that school came from middle-class homes. More detailed data on parental occupations are available for a later period, from the late